Sorry about that. But the other thing is that I learned a lot from Lenny Susskind, and at the beginning of his lectures, he gave a lesson on how to efficiently use blackboards that go up and down. I understood everything Lenny said, but I didn't understand that. So I'll just go on in a random way. I imagine this is a good way to start. So the course is the role of spontaneous breakdown of symmetries in physics. And what does one mean by spontaneous and spontaneous breakdown? It means that configurations, observed configurations of particles and fields, often do not conform to the symmetries of the dynamics which are responsible for those configurations. That is, the dynamical symmetry sometimes implies configurational asymmetry. Things become asymmetric all by itself. Some examples. The table, a translational symmetry. Well, a better, more picturesque example is take a big reservoir of water and put a fish in the middle, and he can't see the edges, and he swims around, and he's in a translationally symmetric medium. But in point of fact, the relative mean positions of all the particles and their orientation with respect one to the other is determined by just a few degrees of freedom. You take a particle and you place it in the corner here, and you take a few neighboring particles and you order its orientation with respect to that one, and the whole thing follows suit. You spontaneously break the translational group. And the fish, of course, thinks he's in a translationally symmetric medium, but the orientation of the particles on the average is fixed. We're going to study most, I put this because it's so familiar. Orientation in a ferromagnet. A ferromagnet is a macroscopic set of spins bearing dipole moments. They have interactions between them, among them. You fix the orientation of one spin, and the orientation of all is fixed. Well, that's very impressive, and because we're talking about numbers, macroscopic numbers, you can have 10 to the Avogadro's number of spins, and just one, orient one, and everything else, all 10 to the 23 are fixed in orientation. Well, that's spontaneous broken symmetry. Why? Because the original Hamiltonian, which governs the interaction, is rotationally symmetric. It's a scalar. It's a rotational scalar. Yet the ground state system is not. So this is very easy to imagine. Then there are more subtle spontaneous broken symmetries. The quantum phase of a quiescent, I take this particular example, it doesn't have to be quiescent, it can move and then one has to discuss further. But the easiest thing to introduce here, of a quiescent superfluid. So it's not flowing. You take a sample of liquid helium, and in one region of the superfluid, you orient and you fix the phase. You know that absolute phase of a quantum system, of an isolated quantum system, is unmeasurable. The spontaneous, that's the symmetry. The Hamiltonian or the Lagrangian is invariant with respect to the phase transformation. And that's the symmetry in question. The spontaneous broken symmetry, if you take just one small region and you fix the phase there, then the phase everywhere is fixed, as if the phase has absolute significance. But it doesn't. It's measured with respect to this one microscopic region. So that's more subtle. And from this issues a great deal of interesting phenomenology, the superfluid helium and superconductors. So that's a lot of fun. Then comes a really interesting example, internal symmetries, isospin, for example. Or more subtle yet, a chiral symmetry. A chiral symmetry is the invariance of a Dirac field when one of the chiral components has its phase fixed. If you can fix the phase of the left, a chiral component of a fermion in that phase of the left is fixed all over. That was the start of it, of the application to elementary particle physics in the hands of Nambu in 1960, the spontaneous broken chiral symmetry. And now I start to qualify. Point four is special. Point four is very special. Because that kind of symmetry is realized in nature really in one and only one way, which is called gauge symmetry. All the other symmetries which I've discussed here, and sometimes the disk symmetry, is effective symmetries, symmetries of effective fields. When you discuss, for example, the orientation of the spins in a ferromagnet, you begin with an elementary Fermi field. But it's not the elementary Fermi field we're discussing. We're discussing a bilinear form, a psi dagger S psi, where S is a vector, a spin vector. It's a bilinear, it's a collective coordinate. And when we were discussing spontaneous broken symmetry, in such models, they're effective theories. When we get to point four, the attitude is being changed because we're there, we're discussing what we believe to be fundamental theories. We're discussing gauge theory, we're discussing electromagnetism or QCD or the standard models. And then there, the symmetries that we're encountering are much more than effective, but they're the real honest-to-God symmetries of nature, and the fundamental symmetries. Whether they will stay fundamental, we don't know, but at this level, we don't make a mistake if we consider them fundamental. And when I say point four is special, it is in that sense, and in particular, if the symmetry is a gauge symmetry, and I'll use another word, local symmetry. This means that whereas until now, take this example, a global symmetry, we have the spins in a ferromagnet, then the symmetry is in question is the invariance of the dynamics when we make a common rotation of all degrees of freedom. That's the kind of symmetries which are discussed here. For example, for the atoms in the table, we have symmetry of a translation. The symmetry in question is the common translation of all atoms. That's a global symmetry. Here we're confronting with a new, we're confronted with a new concept, which is local symmetry, in which, to go back to the ferromagnet, we can rotate one way here and rotate with a different rotational parameter elsewhere in space-time. And that's why I call it a local symmetry. And when that happens, the concept of spontaneous broken symmetry becomes very elusive, because in these cases, when you have the spontaneous broken symmetry in the global case, you're confronted with a system in which the ground state possesses at small temperatures broken symmetry. And that is to say, if you put a small magnetic field on a ferromagnet to give yourself an arrow, and then you go to the limit that the arrow magnitude goes to zero, but it's just left with a direction, like the smile of the Cheshire cat, then, it didn't occur to me, that's a nice simile, then you just have the direction of the spin, but not its the direction of the field, but not its magnitude, and you go to the limit. Then in the limit, you're left with an oriented vacuum. That's what happens for these cases. So you're really left with a vacuum state, which is asymmetric. It's a spontaneously broken symmetry. It's as if the symmetry gets, you tick it a little bit, you turn off the tickling, and you're left with that state. So you're left with a degenerate vacuum. There are many, many vacua according to the directions of all the infinitesimal fields which have been introduced. You have degenerate vacuum. The dynamical consequences of the existence of this degenerate vacuum are very profound. It has a profound influence on the excitation spectrum, on the existence of zero mass particles. In this case, you don't have this concept. The vacuum is not degenerate. There is a unique vacuum. The vacuum is gauge invariant, because you have the freedom to twist one region with respect to the other. The expense, the dynamical expense of being able to do this, is that you have to introduce more degrees of freedom in the system that you started out with. Namely, you introduce a gauge vector fields, you introduce the photon field, you introduce isospin, you introduce the electroweak vector fields, and so on. And the vacuum of such systems is not degenerate, and it's incorrect. The terminology is incorrect to call it spontaneous broken symmetry. I defy you, any of you, to look in the literature and find that that expression is not used. Everybody says spontaneous broken symmetry. Why do they say it? Because the fact is that you pretend that the vacuum is broken, and then you make calculations of certain interesting quantities. And if you're smart enough, you have proven prior to that exercise that there are certain interesting quantities which are gauge invariant properties, gauge invariant Green's functions. And so, for example, the mass of a vector field is a gauge invariant. So you set about calculating that. And then you prove that if you work within a gauge, that is, as if there was spontaneous broken symmetry, then you prove that you get the right answer. But you can also have non-vanishing, non-gauge invariant things. And then you go about proving that when you do the theory correctly, that the non-gauge invariant things don't have any business being there, that the real expectation value is zero, and the gauge invariant ones are the ones you calculated as if there was a spontaneous broken symmetry. So the latter part of the course, once one becomes familiar with the concepts, with easier concepts, we'll be focused on at this point. However, there's already a great deal to be said about these simple effective theories and to become familiar with the concepts. The whole thing began around 1900. Around 1900 were very great years because that's when Lorentz was working, Pierre Weiss was working in Paris, Van der Waals was working in Holland as well as Lorentz. People, and Boltzmann had done his work, and the more advanced thinkers had adopted Boltzmann philosophy that matter was composed of myriads of degrees of freedom, and one could do physics, the statistical physics in terms of these myriad of degrees of freedom. It's not so obvious that the attitude was correct, that Boltzmann's attitude was correct, and the fact that he was unaccepted for a long while drove him nuts. But the smarter people of that time then explored Boltzmann's point of view, and they were working in terms of atomic systems made of many degrees of freedom, which were interacting one with the other. And because of these interactions, each degree of freedom felt an internal, in addition to putting an external field on the system, each of these degrees of freedom felt an internal field due to its interaction with the other degrees of freedom of these myriads. And this whole point of view developed around 1900. You have van der Waals' equation of state, which grew out of that. You had Weiss's theory of ferromagnetism. You had the Lorentz theory of polarization and the theory of electrons and so on. And I'm not going to do all of that. I'm going to focus on Mr. Weiss about 1900. And Weiss's experiments were a measure of the magnetic moment as a function of an external field, but to see what he found as the temperature changed. And he found quite a marvelous phenomenon. This is a saturated value. A saturated value of M. Namely, if M is due to a rotating dipole, then if it's completely oriented, M can only as big get as big as it is if it's completely oriented. And if it flops up and down, then the average value of M will be less than the saturated value. So the question is, as the magnetic field gets reduced from essentially its infinite value, where it will hug the saturated value, where all the dipoles are saturated, what its behavior is. And you have a typically a curve like this. Now the curve I've drawn is for high temperature. Then Weiss lowered the temperature, where Tc is of the order of 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 3 degrees Kelvin, depending on the substance. In iron, it's something like 10 to the 3. Then they lowered the temperature, Weiss lowered the temperature, and the curve became steeper at the origin. And then he lowered the temperature more, and the curve became infinitely steep at the origin. And then he lowered it more, and the curve became and discontinuous. And then he lowered the temperature more and more and more until the discontinuity was the maximal amount of discontinuity, and at T is equal to zero, everything was perfectly polarized. So that's kind of a revolutionary experiment, and I guess people must have been very excited. Now let's look at this quantity M0. That's a function of temperature. As the temperature goes down, his Tc, his T equals zero. His Tc, M0 looks something like that. In fact, Weiss actually measured this, and he found, in very good approximation, that the M0 fell off approximately like the square root of Tc minus T. And now, this was for the limit of H. Suppose the spin had two values, at the double orientation. One is an orientation like that, and the other orientation like that. And then this would be the limit in the plus. And then you can reverse the x, and you can see what would happen if the field got oriented in the other sense, and then like this. That was Weiss's experiment. And that is the magnetic field, the magnetic moment, and it changed in sign. And it was the mirror image. This is a mirror image of that. And that's a consequence of the particular symmetry which I put into the problem, that all up is equivalent to all down. So now, it's very nice that at the same time that these experiments were being done, there were very precise experiments done on the equation of state in Holland. And van der Waal did his experiments. And then if you would look at this curve this way, and then and this would be the PV isotherms, and then this would be the coexistence curve of a liquid and vapor. So later on, I'll discuss with you how you can read these magnetic curves in terms of a liquid and vapor equilibrium. So Weiss gave a nice phenomenological explanation of what he was seeing. He said, there's an internal field due to a spin that's surrounded by others. And so that if I have free spins without interaction, there would be an interaction with the external field which would be oriented. This is the interaction of an internal dipole, a value mu zero s with an external field. And then there would be an internal field. And the internal field, if this is the average value of S, if the thing gets magnetized, because this magnetic moment is identified then with the average value of the spin, of the total spin in some direction, then the H internal is then taken to be proportional to some proportionality factor times the average value of S. So that you have an effective interaction of a spin, which is with one field which is independent of the spin, and then the other field which varies linear in the spin. This is a phenomenological assumption to be explained. But the Weiss had imagination and he tried it out. It couldn't have been all that original, because Lorentz did the same thing in electromagnetism, if you recall. He said that the electric field, that the D field was E plus P, where P was the effect of the surrounding charges or dipoles on a system. So it was in the spirit of the times. Well, then let us say if, I'll call this, if H Turner was zero, then we would have that the magnetic moment would be a function B of H external. Now, from now on, I'm going to change units. The dimensions of H are going to be an energy. So I absorb the a dipole moment into the definition of the field. And then you expect, and I'm going to use the symbol beta, is 1 over kT. And then I'm going to, for the free theory, you expect a curve like that. And then as the temperature goes, as the temperature decreases, the curve becomes steeper and steeper and steeper. So this is the set of curves if H internal is equal to zero. This is the free theory. This B is called the Brillouin function, and the idea simply is if the you have the dipole moment that rotates freely, the average value of the dipole moment is zero. You put on a magnetic field, then the fluctuations are more directed in the sense of the field than in the other sense, and you put on more and more field, and finally for large field, it becomes completely oriented in the direction. But the average value, of course, is disturbed. There's more and more fluctuation the higher the temperature. And since H has the dimensions of an energy, mu H has the dimension of an energy, the only dimensionless quantity that you can make, given this physical picture, is that if this function goes like H over the temperature, an energy over an energy. Okay? So that's the free, that's the picture of the free fluctuating dipole without an internal field. And then Lenny's lesson was I should begin with the top boards and then push the bottom boards up. And now I've learned it. But you have to do the experiment once. So Now weight is simply that m, which is the average value of s in our unit, is b of beta h external plus alpha s. Because this is an energy, this is an energy, this is 1 over an energy, that's the only thing you can write down if you hang on to the physics of that idea. Okay? So that's the phenomenology. And now you look at H okay, so for small beta, high T, high temperature, then we know if the temperature is infinite that there should be no moment of H external goes to zero. So we can plot for small beta S as a function of H external. And if beta is sufficiently small, that is, the temperature sufficiently high, it should be linear. And we expect a linear relation, and it should go up. And so we have to expand this linearly for this example, that S is equal to, and I'll forget a relevant constant, the beta H external plus the beta alpha S plus and so on. And so in the linear domain, I'm discussing the characterization of the curve here, where you do have a linear response, then we find that S is equal to beta X external 1 minus beta alpha. Now you see, I said alpha on dimensional grounds ought to be an energy. Well, here it comes up. This is the ratio of alpha to the temperature. So what can alpha be? Alpha is the characteristic energy of a system. So to identify alpha, then the internal Hamiltonian, okay, magnetic fields are curly H, Hamiltonians are straight H's. Let us suppose that there is a spin-spin interaction, and let us suppose that the whole system is endowed with isotropy, as isotropic symmetry, rotational symmetry. So there's going to be, and the spin is a vector, so there's going to be a scalar which is going to characterize this interaction, and the Vij is the interaction between pairs. And if it's a ferromagnet, Vij is greater than zero if I put a minus sign here, because then the parallel configuration of spins is energetically favored. And for simplicity, Ij are to use the Canadian language, are like neighbors. If Canadians love the word like, they don't have to be neighbors, they can be second neighbors or 10 neighbors, but it's something with a range. So then clearly alpha, well, if this is the case, the internal field, the curly H, the internal field due to the external field is minus, the internal field on I is minus the sum on J, Vij, sum on J. Or, you know, like in electromagnetism, when you have a Coulomb interaction and the electric field is the derivative of the electromagnetic energy with respect to the density. This is a derivative of the magnetic energy with respect to the magnetic density. It's the same thought. It's no accident that all of this happened. Lorentz, as I say, van der Waals and Weiss all came together. It's all the same thinking. So compare that with the original Weiss phenomenology, and we find that alpha, we find that the Weiss theory, the average here, we find the identification of the parameter alpha is minus J, Vij, for every I, and Vij is V of Ri minus Rj. It has therefore alpha is independent of the origin Ri. I have a spin I, and I did some on the interaction with the neighbors around it, so the result is independent of the choice of origin. Trouble? No. Well, I'm not as tall as Lenny, so I can't get to the top floor. Now, we have this phenomenon of the slope. We've duplicated the experiment of the slope increasing as the temperature gets lower and lower until we hit this singularity, and we've identified the physics of why this occurs. It's when the internal field, when the mean internal field becomes comparable to the temperature. And then the system reacts in a very strong way, and it develops an infinite response. And when you lower the temperature a little bit more beyond the alpha parameter there, then it takes a jump, and you get a singular response. So we're on the ball of what spontaneous breakdown. If the field went the other way, then the jump would be in the other direction. So we're now identifying the origin of spontaneous broken symmetry, namely when the field goes to zero in a certain direction, when the temperature becomes low enough, there is a spontaneous induction of an average magnetization in that direction when T is less than TC. Where TC, I'll introduce some notation. Oh. You don't think to stand on the chair? Oh, hockey stick. Ah. I'm going to call the Fourier transform. VI, I'm sorry, V of Q. And what we have in what I shall call mean field theory. Mean field because the internal field has been approximated by its mean. Given a polarization S, I have made the approximation that the internal field is proportional to the mean magnetization. Why is that a lie? Because if I am polarizing, if this I know to be polarized in that direction, then I know that there, because of the immediate near-neighbor interaction with its neighbor J, that J will be more polarized than on the average, and that there's going to be a correlation. And that correlation of the polarization of I with its neighbors J is not taken into account in the mean field approximation. So Weiss theory is justifiably called the mean field approximation. And then we're going to go a little bit into trying to correct for that idea. And if time allows at the end, we'll see how it goes. Or we can put in some extra lectures, and then I'll show you how Wilson, in the latter days in the 1960s, was able to give a complete account for this correlation effect, at least for at temperatures near the critical temperature and at the small magnetic fields. And that's a whole chapter in itself. So for the moment, we're going to work in this physical approximate way, which catches a great deal of the truth. And if time allows, we'll catch up and come closer to the real truth. But as I say, that's a field in itself called a critical phenomena and a critical field theory. Now, in mean field theory, then, we have M is equal to B. So M, by M here, I mean the average value of the spin in the direction of a field, H external. And this is B then. So H external, I'm not going to put a vector, otherwise I'll have to put vectors in the equation everywhere. Plus V0. M. And B, in general, is some function that looks like that. And according to the model, whether you have spin a half or spin three halves or an infinite number of spins, which is normalized to one on a unit sphere, there's all kinds of models that you can play with, then you have different values of B. But they all show the saturated behavior here and the linear behavior here. So this is a universal characterization of the function B, and this is a universal characterization. So from now on, I'm going to specialize in being showing you the generalities on the spin model. I'm going to specialize for a while on the Ising model, where Si is mu I, which is a two-valued function. Now, I'm sure that all of you have gone to talks where you've seen effective potentials which have double wells And then they say that because there's internal symmetry, that you take that double well and you rotate it. For the moment, we're just going to have the double well. And then in a half hour, we're going to rotate it. And then the single well is going to be the Ising model. And then the more general well is where we're going to generalize it to vectors. So I want to get a better handle on beginning to get closer to the foundations using fundamental notions, like the fundamental notions of statistical mechanics, get hold of the foundations of that equation using a partition function and stuff like that. And so the next thing is how to get Weiss from StatMech. So you begin with the partition function. And I remind you that the Helmholtz free energy is related to the partition function. The log of the partition function is minus F over KT, where F is the Helmholtz free energy. And in your notes, if you take notes, don't write free energy, write Helmholtz free energy. Because we're going to make a distinction between Gibbs free energy and Helmholtz free energy. The partition function is given by the Boltzmann factor, and the trace over all 2 to the n spin configurations. Note that these spin configurations and the whole thing has a mirror symmetry, has a reflection symmetry. If the Hamiltonian it doesn't have a reflection symmetry if I have an external field. So this is a symmetry breaker. That breaks up and down. I'm going to put a minus sign because I like spins always. I like the low energy to be where the spin is parallel to the field. So that's why I put a minus. A minus Bij over 2 times Uj. And the minus sign and the Vij is greater than 0. So the interaction favors the parallel configurations of spins. Well, question, beginning from here, how do you get to there? I can't get to there without erasers. Oh, yes, I can. The way I'll do it is I'm going to peel the skin. I'm going to write Z have I used the symbol M yet? I want to reserve them. No, I haven't. That's okay. So I'm going to peel the contributions to the partition function, skin layer by layer, M by M. And I'm going to investigate the properties of ZM. And in particular, I'm going to investigate its variational properties and show that ZM is dominated by a particular value of M, called M star, about which the fluctuations are infinitesimal. So that we're going to prove this is to prove where M star is the extremum, and the log N incorporates the Gaussian fluctuations about the extremum, and we're going to investigate the properties of the extremal value of M. And in the mean field approximation, we're going to find precisely that the extremum obeys the Weiss equation. So that's how we get it. So the relation to between statistical mechanics and the Weiss theory is through the extremals. And for those of you who have a good course in statistical mechanics, this is familiar to you, because you know that you can work with a grand partition function where the number of particles at fixed pressure and volume is fixed, and n is a varying quantity. You can have a membrane in which particles come in and out of a reservoir, but you know that the average value of N is fixed, and that's the same physics. It's the same statistical mechanics, if you like. We are working with a grand partition function of spins, and we're going to a petite partition function where M, the number of oriented spins, it governs the problem. So that's the analogy. And to prove it is pretty easy. ZM, you know, if physics is the art of writing that A over A is 1, or A minus A is 0, here it's 1 over 1 is equal to 1. So WM is the number of spins, the number of configurations subject to the constraint that M is what it is. Okay. So a WM is the total number of configurations which are realized by the constraint that the sum on the orientation of all the spins is equal to m. Or, are you tempting the speaker? That would be very nice of you. I'm sorry. I would love it because I'm getting hoarse. I do not need a bun, but something to drink would be very nice. Thank you very much. And WM, everybody knows. And a binomial coefficient. And by Stirling. From now on, I'm not going to include the corrections. This is of order 10 to the 23. This is of order 23. So, that is. Is everybody okay with that? And the Stirling approximation? Thank you very much. Very kind of you. Thanks so much. Sugar not, but. Oh. Okay, so we have one part. Well, we can start. We can erase the introduction. As we slowly slip into the thick of it. And you'll see it becomes more and more elegant as we go. Oh, I forgot. I was going to begin the course with a quotation from Nabokov, who the literary criticism I've been taking a look at lately. And there's a sentence, I read it, unfortunately, it translated from English into French. So it's a paraphrase, but I meant to write this to begin, because this is what's going to happen in this course. A great thinking has the precision of poetry and the imagination of science. Which I find delightful. It's so completely contradictory to the attitude of the common man, but it truly is that way. And this field really is filled with imagination. Even Weiss's thinking is absolutely remarkable. And that's pure imagination. Well, we now have to begin with our construction here. So the log of Z of M No, I'm not sure I'm going to get all my signs right. Maybe I should follow my notes. No, of course. The definition for any operator, for any function, is you divide by the total number of configurations consistent with the constraint, and you take the average of the operator in the ensemble. That's because this is wrong. I said I should look at my notes. Zm is the number of configurations. Wait. Zm okay. So that first term is this one, and this is the one. I got it wrong, excuse me. It's that I need a cup of coffee. This one is the average of this in this constricted ensemble. So this is the average value of a function, or it could be an operator in quantum mechanics, the subject in an ensemble subject to the constraint, where all members of that ensemble subject to the constraint are equal a priori probable. And we want the average. Now, in the theory of probability, one introduces from the most simple examples the Laplace transform of the distribution. P of x being positive everywhere. And this defines what's called the cumulant generating function. Where C1. And so on. Oh, this plays a very fundamental role in the theory of probability, in proving the central limit theorem, and so on. And now this construction, this is just an aside, this construction can be generalized. With too many variables. Always the same alpha. For us, this parameter alpha is related to beta there. So, to many variables, so this can be x1 plus x2 plus x3 and so on, and also generalized to functions. Like, I can have e to the minus alpha f of x1, f of x2, and so on. You can put anything you like here, and you can define the CNs accordingly. But the important thing is that it's a function of the alpha. There's only one alpha. So in our particular example, I consider what sits here as a random variable of the spins mu. So this is the log of this function of random variables. So I apply this definition. And the reason I'm doing this in detail is not only to get the answer, but to illustrate what's being neglected in molecular field theory. Because at the same time that we want to understand the molecular field theory, we want to understand, or mean field theory, and we want to understand what's wrong with it, when it goes wrong. So I'm going to make a power series in minus beta to the n over n factorial, c1 plus c2 and so on. It's cn. And then c1 is the average value of the Hamiltonian, c2 is now, you don't have to know anything about probability theory and accumulants to write this down. You just do it and you check that it's right. But for those who do know probability theory, it's good to know that it comes from a well-known procedure. MFT. Uses only C1. Neglects all the rest. Now, first of all, I'll show you that, and then we'll discuss the nature of the content of the rest that's being neglected. Okay, so I am not equal to J. Better. Okay, for I not equal to J, there is a correction. There is a correction. A plus order 1 over N. For I not equal to J, I have an ensemble in which every spin configuration is equally a priori probable, subject only to one constraint, that the sum of all the spins is equal to M. Therefore, whether I work the average of mu 1 times mu 2, or the average of mu 1 times mu 27, I don't care, because the constraint does not involve the distance between the spins. It's just a global constraint, with only one exception, which is that when the two spins are equal, when I is equal to J, then mu squared is equal to 1. That's the model. Mu I is plus or minus 1, and so mu I squared is equal to 1. So because there are no exceptions, in order to work this out, what I can do is I can sum. Oh, you want me to do it, or you want to have the fun? It's fun to do it. Okay. Just leave the blank and do the mathematics, do the algebra. Let's just sum it on I and J over all I and J. Use the constraint and subtract the error when I is equal to J. And then you get that. Sold? No. I'll do it. I don't want discomfort. Remember, I want this for I not equal to J because the Hamiltonian, the interaction part of the Hamiltonian, contains Vij, and Vij exists between neighbors, but Vij is defined to be zero when the spins that are on the same side. So I want I not equal to J. Well, I'm going to make a mistake, and I'm going to forget that. So I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to subtract N for the case. So this is all I and J. And so for I not equal to J, mu I mu J average are these sums minus the number of mistakes I make, which is n. But mu I, in the constrained ensemble, by definition, is m. So this m is of order n. It's a number of up spins. So m is n times a fraction of spins which are up. So m is of order n. So this is of order n squared, and that's of order n. So whenever I do this, I'm in what's called the thermodynamic limit. The thermodynamic limit is defined as that you divide by n and take n goes to infinity to take the leading term. So I have now calculated C1. Now, when did I erase? Oh, here. There's a fragment of the formula left. This formula. I defined a little m here. When I used the Stirling approximation. So I'll express this in terms of little n. what's going on. Why am I not getting the right answer? That's right. Oh, this is. That's interesting. Okay. Right. Mu I, mu j average. Yeah, here. This gave me that mu I, this exercise gave me that mu I average m is m over n. That's the result of these two lines. I put it in. It's independent of the relative distance for I not equal to j. So here I have vij m n over n squared. And then that's what I call little m. And therefore, this is equal to minus 1/2. Now, this is a function of ri minus rj. So fix I and sum over all sites j. This is independent of j. So that's another factor of n, the number of sites. The rest is the sum on j for I fixed. And that's what I call v of 0, m squared. Thus, I have a beautiful expression. My signs. A W of M was 2 to the n minus log, so this is log W. And I, yeah, so there's a minus. There's a minus. And the Stirling thing. So that's the W of M expression, independent of N in the thermodynamic limit. This is the interaction with the external field. This is a magnetic moment per particle. I think that 2 hours is too long because you're all getting as tired as I am. We should discuss what to do about it. Maybe you would like a rest in the middle and I get to 10 minutes and I could go over 10 minutes. So you get your money's worth anyway. You tell me what you want next time, okay? And then there are some betas. So that's what you get for C1. And now we're looking for the extremum. At fixed n. So that's equivalent to extremizing with respect to little m. Now, then what do you get? So that's the Weiss theory, where the Brillouin function is the tanche. You see that the energy parameter is the interaction of a spin with its neighbors, as if all the neighbors were up. You see that when the temperature, when the beta is small, you can expand, and that when H external is equal to zero. But you see that if beta V zero exceeds unity, that the initial slope is greater than unity, and the left hand side is linear in M. So you have regular behavior only if beta V zero is less than one. If beta V0 is greater than 1, then you have to look for the other solution. And the other solutions are the ones that I've obtained from the Weiss phenomenology. The conclusion, the Weiss phenomenology, which was a pure guess, is derivable. And this, the first derivation I ever saw was in the late 1930s by Kirkwood in Journal of Chemical Physics. So it was almost 40 years after the phenomenology was made, and that there was an inkling of a derivation. That's pretty good, and that Kirkwood got that. Now let's go back and find out what we neglected. Chapter one is finished. We start chapter two. Chapter two begins with C2, for example. Now, C2 involves the expectation value of the Hamiltonian squared minus the expectation value of the Hamiltonian squared minus the expectation squared of the Hamiltonian. Now, in the Hamiltonian, there occurs, I'm getting tired and I won't write down all the details, but you can believe it. You have that the Hamiltonian is a sum on all pairs. So the pair 27, 28 here, and the pair 115 and 116 there are not talking very much to each other. And you can prove mathematically that those distant pairs at the level of C2 are uncorrelated. At the level of C128, they will be correlated. Now, therefore, at the level of C2, the only things which are neglecting are those pairs which are near each other. And when you go through the arithmetic, then the interesting thing is that even you look at the same pair in C2, you have V12, mu1, mu2. So that involves the square of the interaction between 1 and 2, which is the mu1 times mu2 minus mu1, mu2 squared. So now are you beginning to see mu 1 squared mu 2. Yeah. Right? Because mu 1, mu 2 at the level of the approximation where the effective ensemble is the ensemble where the only constraints are that the sums of the upspins are equal to m, then this is obviously equal to m times the spin per particle, and that comes in square. And then you go on, and then there's a technology. And in fact, when I was a young man, and that's how I got started in this business, because I read Kirkwood's article, and then I went on and on and on. And I looked at the CNs, and I developed tools. I'm not going to pursue that tactic, one can, because I would rather do things from a more physical point of view. In fact, the way I did it first was I did the mathematics first, and then I tried to understand what I was doing. And that's what I'm going to report on here. Now, but you see that what I am neglecting is the correlations. What I'm neglecting is that the neighbor, if I have this spin up, after all, what is mu 1, mu 2 average? Mu 1, 2 is the average value of mu 1 of mu 2 if mu 1 is up. That is, if I put mu 1 up, and here's mu 2, and that's going to polarize its neighbors. So in this guy, if I put mu 1 up, which I can do, because mu 1, I won't go into the rigor of the argument. It is a correct argument, and this is a correct statement. It's an exact statement. Then this is the average value of mu 2. So the correlations which are interesting are the correlations of what happens to the neighbors given the configuration of a given spin. And you want to make a theory of those correlations, and that's going to give you the corrections to the Weiss theory. Now, who cares? Well, the Weiss theory has something wrong with it. I mean, epistemologically wrong. Why? Because if H external is equal to zero, the energy, which is d log z, d beta, is equal to 1/2 v zero m squared, if h external is equal to zero. And this is equal to zero if m is equal to zero. And m is equal to zero if h is equal to zero if t is greater than the critical temperature. I only induce a spontaneous magnetic moment at low temperatures, but for temperatures above the critical temperature, there is no spontaneous magnetic moment. So I'm saying that there is no energy in the Weiss theory above the critical temperature if the external field is equal to zero. But that's nonsense, because above the critical temperature, even at H external is equal to zero, you cannot sell me that mu 1, mu 2 average is equal to zero. Because mu 1, mu 2 means the average value of mu 2 if mu 1 is up, independent of the total value of m. Therefore, Weiss is intrinsically dissatisfactory. It's a nice approximation. It illustrates spontaneous magnetization, but it clearly has a missing a fundamental ingredient. So as a first orientation, we want to cure that flaw. And we shall. But we're not going to cure it completely, because if the dimensionality of the system is less than 4, the nature of the singularities are such that the complete cure is extremely complicated. It involves a theory of intersecting loops and when the dimensionality is less than 4, that problem becomes an extremely complicated problem. When the dimensionality is greater than 4, then it's a trivial problem, and then Weiss theory is okay. So had we been living in a four-dimensional Euclidean world, I would have stopped the lesson here. But we have to go into this business now. So we'll do that now. And for that, I've decided to go into a formulation of the problem which harkens back to the field theory of Schwinger and Martin. Now, I haven't shown you that the spin problem is isomorphic to a field theory. For this hour, it's true. And the next time I'll begin by showing you the transformation which permits you to treat the spin problem, which we're treating here, to a field theory, to a standard field theory with Feynman diagrams and all the rest. So that's for next time. Nevertheless, I'm going to introduce a technique to do this problem where I don't need the whole formalism, but it's just common sense, which is comes out of the knowledge of the Schwinger-Martin formalism of field theory, or what Schwinger used to call sorcery. The source theory he called sorcery. And what we're going to do is I'm going to begin with H external equal to zero and T greater than TC. Let's see, already we have shown that we have headaches enough for this simple case, where you don't have spontaneous magnetization and you get zero energy when we damn well know that we shouldn't get zero energy. So let's see how we get some energy under these conditions, which are the simplest conditions. And we're going to write the Hamiltonian as 1/2 Vij. Oh, and then the next time we're going to go from the two-valued spins, the Ising spins, we're going to go to vectors, and we're going to dress the whole thing up in a little more sophisticated way. But the essentials are all going to be here. And plus. Little h. Minus. To be consistent with our minus. No, I don't know what book to recommend to you for field theory, for the theory of sources. Does anybody have a suggestion? I find that Vamont is a nice book, but sometimes it gets terribly complicated, much, much too complicated than you need. And I'm not familiar with other books. What book? Okay, well, you tell. A writer?
Writer.
Writer. Now, I'm going to write down the partition function. And then we're going to use sorcery. Now, if we went to the limit with h, little h going to 0 right away, we would find the correct value that under these conditions that the magnetic moment is equal to 0. So we better not do that yet. But if we take a second derivative, and then we get the fluctuation. Now you see that when you take the first derivative, you pull down a value of mu I. When you take the second derivative, you pull down a mu I, a sum on a mu I and a mu j. So when you take the second derivative, you pull down a mu I and a mu j. That's that term. However, we must recall that this is the trace of mu I e to the minus a beta Hamiltonian over z, this guy. So when we take a second derivative, we pull down a mu j from the derivative of there, that's here. And we take the derivative of the denominator. And when we take the derivative of the denominator, we pull down the average of mu j. So this is what Schwinger called sorcery. And that was quite a simplification in the manipulations of field theory and Feynman diagrams in the 1950s. And now, when we take h external to 0, mu I is 0, but mu j is not equal to 0. There's no reason why the average value of mu I, mu j should be equal to 0, because I said it's the correlation induced on a neighboring spin, given that one spin is already polarized. So this is the quantity that we're after. And this will bear the correction to the Weiss theory, because the energy is Vij mu I mu j average. So if we can get an estimate of mu I mu j average, we are on the road to finding the nature of the corrections to the Weiss theory. And it turns out, not only are we correcting for something which is obviously wrong, we're going to turn up things which are very revealing in our inner dynamics, which are very revealing when we go through the formalism in this way. So what we're going to do is we're going to do ways, but just a little bit better. What I told you is one of the reasons that is interesting is the following also. It's not only for the energy. If I introduce the Fourier transform of the spin density, the Fourier transform of the spin density tells me how rapidly a spin configuration is varying. And mu q squared under these conditions is mu I mu j e to the I q dot r I minus r j. So, and this is not equal to zero. This is equal to zero if under these conditions always. I'm always going to. This is zero. But this is not equal to zero in general, because it involves a mu I mu j average.
First, the expectation value
of
mu k is zero.
I have to get close to that.
The expectation value of
mu q
is zero, or
mu
q itself is zero.
Mu q is equal to zero if H external is equal to zero and T is greater than TC, because mu I is equal to zero. The average value of mu I is equal to zero.
Yeah, it's not the individual
value. Okay. No, mu I is plus or minus one.
Yeah.
So this is not equal to zero. And as I told you, the interest of this calculation is a lot more than just confronting this obvious absurdity that the energy shouldn't be equal to zero above the critical point. But this is something that you measure. And you measure with very precise measurements. And you measure it, for example, mu q squared for spin. A neutron beam having a spin is coupled to the spin system of a lattice, and mu q squared then average is equal to the power scattered by the from the neutron beam by the spin system. So scattering experiments reveal the nature of the correlations. So I decided to throw this propaganda in before going in, because it's more than motivated simply from energy. It's a very fundamental thing. And in the 1920s, this was extremely important. And then later on in the 1950s, when they made the neutron beams, then in the 1920s, it was with the light beams. And then it was density. And then you had the Tyndall, the critical opalescence experiments, and then you had Einstein and Smoligorsky. So this was a very important chapter in history, of these correlations in the history of science. And actually, it reinforced, these experiments reinforced in no uncertain way the general atomic picture and the atomic fluctuations, which at that time were rather new. So this modified MIT field theory is that I'm gonna write down the whole thing. Right, I begin here. This is the average value of mu I. I take the derivative with respect to hj, and there are two ways to write it, either this way, or just write it, the average value of mu I with respect to hj. I'm taking the derivative of that with respect to hj, and then put hj equal to zero after I take the derivative. Okay? Well, that way to write it opens the avenue to the calculation. The mean field modification is that the field I'm going to be too low. Modified. It's a modified mean field on I. So this is a mean field because I have a little source field, HI. The little source field introduces a little expectation value of mu, which is precisely the thing I'm interested in. I'm looking at the neighbors. Suppose this guy is up. Suppose that would be the source field, the guy who's up there. And then this induces a little bit of polarization here. So this catches the spirit of the physics very well. And therefore, the average value of mu I would be tanh. Let's give this a name. Tanh beta HI modified. Okay. And since everything is small here, this is. I'm getting worn out too. And that's not what I want to do. I should follow my notes. Mu I, mu j is d mu I, d h j So I take the derivative of that. And the derivative of that. That's what happens after you get tired. D H J. Okay. I have. Oh no, but I didn't. I'm sorry. I am getting tired. The mean field is this, and therefore mu I is the tanh of the unmodified mean field. But since the mean field is small, we can work in the linear approximation. So we can work, so instead of using the tanh, we use this expression itself. Is my blackboard too messy? Linearize, that is mu I, is equal to the tanh of the modified field and that's equal to the modified field itself. Up to a factor of beta. There's a beta. This is now dimensionally correct. So that's it. So I have an integral equation. May I erase? Now, normally you would say, just solve it by convolution. However, you can't solve it just straightforwardly by convolution because there's one exceptional term, that VII is equal to zero. And for the case, K is equal to J, mu K squared is equal to one. But these exceptional terms, but we're going to find out that the range of the correlation as t approaches tc goes to infinity. So the error you make in ignoring the proviso that k is not equal to j, the error that you make that in the proviso that k is not equal to j is a negligible error if you are near the critical point. If you are near t is equal to tc, and if you are near h external is equal to zero, then you make negligible errors. And therefore you forget that proviso. This is called the excluded volume proviso. And by the way, I mentioned to you that there was a whole technology to get the exact theory where these excluded volumes then play an important role to get the exact answer. A correlation is long range. Then you get, by Fourier transform, that mu q squared is equal to 1, you take the Fourier transform, plus And there should be a beta there. I told you that there's a tanh, there's a beta there, plus beta. V of Q. Mu Q squared. Where mu Q squared is the thing I introduced. Yeah, that. So that's the integral equation convoluted. And mu Q squared. It's 1 over 1 minus beta V of Q. And then we'll close the session. But there's something which is designed to whet your appetite. It's how is it that the fluctuations blow up at the same temperature when H external is equal to zero, how is it that the fluctuations blow up when the self-consistent Weiss equation begins to have a non-trivial solution? It's a very interesting question. In fact, you're beginning to see that the whole business of getting ordered phase is an interlocking between mean concepts and fluctuation concepts. So the next question is, and what we'll answer next time, is to show you the physics about why this happens, why this thing blows up at the same time that Weiss theory has a non-trivial solution. And that will lead us to a very important chapter, which is called the theory of the effective potential. Which is behind all the physics that's been done in spontaneous broken symmetry, when you have gauge theory, when you have non-gauge theory. This will be our entrance into the theory of the effective potential and the introduction of Skene and mesons and field theory and all of that. Okay. Oh, I didn't realize 2 hours was so long.